Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Summer is starting, which means with a couple of blinks, it'll be fall. And fall means midterm elections. If you've gotten lost in the redistricting back and forths and the nitty-gritty of what the stakes are for the midterms, we don't blame you. It's a lot. But we'll walk you through some of the main topics. Let's start with WWL in New Orleans.
Tyler Bridges joins us now, our friend, chief political reporter for The Advocate.
Hello. There's this hot and heavy Senate race right now where Bill Cassidy is in the fight of his life, and polls are showing that there's a good chance he's going to lose on Saturday to end his political career because President Trump endorsed Julia Letlow, the representative who lives in Baton Rouge. And meanwhile, just not to confuse things more, the legislature is meeting on redistricting. And I was at the Capitol on Friday. There was a huge turnout of people who are opposed to the Republicans wanting to come up with a plan to eliminate one or both of Louisiana Black Democratic seats in Congress.
No matter what's going to happen, somebody's going to get sued over this, right?
Well, lawsuits have already begun over Governor Landry's decision to cancel the House elections. And then there will be lawsuits over whatever the legislature comes up with in the new map for the House races that will be held later this year. And we've seen this now in other states where Republicans are in control, trying to eliminate Democratic seats following the Supreme Court ruling that race could not be used in drawing congressional boundaries.
All right, so we got a couple of very powerful Louisianians in the House, Mike Johnson and Steve Scalise. Are their districts going to change? Are their seats at risk, or are they thinking of maybe moving on and doing something else?
So redistricting normally takes place after the census happens, but President Trump asked Texas to, in the middle of the decade, to redraw its lines to create more Republican seats. And so then we saw a war going on in different states. Louisiana wasn't going to do anything until the Supreme Court made its ruling that the current map is unconstitutional. Now, the people that draw the maps for Congress are state legislators, and what they typically do is they make the maps, particularly now, very partisan, and they also, it's incumbent protection. So Mike Johnson and Steve Scalise will absolutely have safe seats. And that's fitting into the question of whether the legislature will try to draw a 6-0 map, meaning all members of Congress, all seats would be drawn to elect Republicans, or potentially a 5-1 map. Right now it's 4-2, 4 Republicans, 2 Democrats, the 2 Democrats being Troy Carter of New Orleans and Cleo Fields of Baton Rouge. So the question of the future of Mike Johnson and Steve Scalise is, if the Republicans lose the midterm elections in the House this year, will Mike Johnson and Steve Scalise, they would then be in the minority, would they still want to stay in Congress? Because we've seen leaders of Congress, you know, speakers of the House, once they lose the majority, in several cases on the Republican side, they simply resign. So there is that possibility. And there are members of the state Senate who are looking to run for the Scalise seat or the Mike Johnson seat in case that happens.
They're making Scalise and Johnson almost $200,000 a year right now. But if they were each to leave and go to K Street, they could write their own ticket pretty much, could they not?
Yeah, we've seen former members of Congress make a lot of money because they become very knowledgeable. You know, Bob Livingston, former representative from Jefferson Parish, you know, he did very well as a lobbyist. Former Senator John Breaux, a Democrat, for 3 terms in the Senate, and Bennett Johnston, another one. They did very well as lobbyists once they left the Capitol.
Is the redistricting that's going on around the country after the Supreme Court ruling likely to put whatever advantage the Democrats had, given the fact that usually it swings the other way after a Republican is elected president, at risk or not? Or does it look as though still the Republicans going to lose the House?
Well, this appears to be a good Democratic year for a couple of reasons. One is President Trump is very unpopular, and as you noted, traditionally in the midterm election after presidential election, the party that won the White House usually loses seats in Congress. So you add all that together and the expectation it'll be a good Democratic year, that the Republicans are likely to lose the House and could well lose the Senate as well. Now, President Trump has tried to make changes by asking Republican states to redraw their lines to eliminate Democratic seats. And that's been happening. Democrats have countered in Democratic seats and have eliminated Republican congressional seats. And then on top of that, to add to all the confusion, the Supreme Court handed down its ruling that will eliminate Democratic seats held by African Americans in the South, particularly that race can no longer be a factor. And so a lot of those seats are now at risk, including one or both of the seats held by Black Democrats in Congress in Louisiana.
Bottom line, does it seem as though the Republicans could district themselves out of a good year for the Democrats or not?
The current analysis is that the Supreme Court ruling could hand as many as give Republicans an additional 10 seats that were not expected. And that's possible that could that the Democrats then would not win enough seats in all the other races around the country to win control of the House. And that's the battle that's going on right now.
The Republicans were to hold a majority. Chances are they don't go anywhere.
Absolutely. Mike Johnson presumably would continue as Speaker. And the number two guy would be Steve Scalise. You know, Scalise being from Jefferson Parish and Mike Johnson from Northwest Louisiana.
I can guarantee you that the jockeying has already begun, the jockeying for position. So if Scalise or Johnson were to resign, who are some of the people looking at their seats if the Democrats should win the House in November?
The name for Steve Scalise's seat you hear most often is a state senator named Kirk Talbot. The thought had been that Cameron Henry, who is now the state senate president, was going to be the guy, but he has said no, he would not run for Scalise's seat. Cameron Henry was an aide to Steve Scalise and is very close to him. Up in Northwest Louisiana, there's a state senator named Thomas Presley, who is positioning himself to run for Mike Johnson's seat should Johnson resign. Again, that would only happen if the Democrats won the midterm election.
So that's the lay of the land where the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and powerful Steve Scalise are concerned. But how about the seat once owned by Nancy Pelosi? Here's KCBS in San Francisco.
Our KCBS insider, Phil Matier. So, Phil, we have State Senator Scott Wiener, Supervisor Connie Chan, and former AOC Chief of Staff Saikat Chakrabarty. Who do you see resonating with San Francisco voters, at least at this point?
At this point, in the recent Chronicle poll showed that Scott Wiener is commanding lead, overwhelming, with 40% of those polled saying that they were inclined to vote for him or were already made up their minds. Chakrabarty, who is a lefty Bernie type guy who's trying to run on the Mondavi populist fever, is it only at 18%. And Connie Chan, the supervisor in San Francisco who is running with the support of labor, is only at 17%. If this was a regular, like, old-fashioned primary where the top Democrat and the top Republican went into the final, then Scott Wiener would be measuring the curtains for his new office in the House of Representatives. But Steve, it's not. What we have here is, remember, it's the top two vote getters that go into the runoff.
Bill, it's interesting. Nancy Pelosi has supported, but not fully endorsed, Connie Chan. And then you have AOC and Saikat Chakrabarty. I mean, he used to be her chief of staff. She's been invisible as far as supporting him. Would you expect them, Pelosi and AOC, to maybe step forward and be a little more visible in this race?
Not in the first round, Steve, not in the primary. You're going to see a lot of Democrats just standing back. Okay, let's take two for example. One, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck and Scott Wiener. She's not crazy about Scott Wiener because, remember, he was making noise. It was time for her to go, and he was going to run whether she stayed or not. That wasn't a great way to go for the personal relationship. On the other hand, she can't stand Chakrabarty because he's this progressive guy that she's been opposed to, so she's not crazy about that. And Connie Chan, she's not sure she's going to win. And by the way, just as the subplot on all this, Nancy Pelosi would like her daughter Christine to run and take Scott Wiener's seat. So the sooner she can get him out of the state Senate, the sooner they can have a special election, and her daughter could possibly win that. So it's a three-dimensional chess game, but right now everybody's batting their eyes, smiling and stuff, but nothing official until after, I think it's going to see after the runoff, and they say, okay, what's going to happen now?
Here's more from Tommy Tucker on who's really winning hearts and minds in the battle over redistricting.
Dr. Robert Hogan joins us now, our friend, professor, and department chair of political science at LSU. Talk about redistricting efforts, not just here, but around the country. Let's go back to, I guess, the Supreme Court ruling and how it affected both Louisiana and Virginia, but in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court decision was a bombshell in that it has upended a lot of the expectations about what the current election is going to be like, perhaps, and certainly what future elections are going to be like. I mean, and basically it said that race could not be used as a factor in redistricting efforts. And that has launched efforts in several states to redistrict to be in compliance with the Supreme Court's understanding of the Constitution. Virginia, of course, is they had a very different still have a very different system than Louisiana has, in that an independent redistricting commission makes decisions about redistricting efforts. But the legislature stepped in and altered that system so in order to give the Democrats an advantage there. And the state Supreme Court of Virginia came back and said they did not follow the correct procedures in doing so. And so the new map that had been adopted that gave Democrats an advantage of four additional seats in that state was struck down. And so this is all part of the redistricting war. You've got a couple things going on. You've got a redistricting war, and in the midst of it, you have the Supreme Court coming down with its vision of new constitutional principles that have to be applied. So you have a lot of scrambling across the state as each party is trying to take advantage of the situation in a way that benefits their party. Both parties, I think, are trying to win. I think what you see with the Democrats is that they face, in terms of redistricting states, they face some structural advantages that Republicans don't face. A lot of the Republican states, Texas, for example, Florida, they don't have these independent commissions. They don't have this. The legislature can come in along with the governor and redistrict whenever they want. The hurdle was much higher in Virginia, much higher as well as in California, where the legislature had to go in and through actually the state voters had to okay a constitutional amendment to undo that and unwind that independent commission. So you have some structural advantages there that are different for the Republican Democratic Party. So the Democrats are in much more of a reactive stance here. And so you also don't have the Democrats being pressured, I think, by Washington. I think that Donald Trump, as his role as president, as head of the Republican Party, is making demands of legislatures. And we know that if you don't follow his demands, what the consequences can be. Just ask the senators in Indiana, the Republicans that lost their jobs this past week, what happens when they cross the president. So there are consequences for not following through. So it's a structural advantage I think Republicans have, as well as the political nature of what's going on. You have the Republicans in Washington really pushing this. So I think that's why you see some differences here.
So, Doctor, going back to the Voting Rights Act, and my question is, it about race or party? Because I hear people in Louisiana say, I don't think 6-0 would be practical, more like 5-1. But the question then becomes, who's the 5 and who's the 1? Is it Democrats and Republicans? Is it white or is it black? And is it inherently about race? And if that's the case, was it because black people were disadvantaged when the Voting Rights Act came about, and that righted a wrong? And is the wrong still there that needs to be righted, or have things become level? I mean, that ultimately is the discussion, right?
Well, I mean, race and partisan identification are very much intertwined, and that has sort of been the major nub of the issue here that justices have grappled with, as well as the public. I mean, you know, the Voting Rights Act was enacted in order to give minorities a voice in the government, in a way that they hadn't had before. And if they cannot elect someone who represents them, who descriptively represents them, are they actually having a real voice in the political system? And I mean, this is the issue. The Supreme Court declared in 2019 that partisan gerrymandering is fine. Legislatures can carve up districts in whatever way they want. And that has for partisan means. And the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago said that, well, you can still do that, but you can't base that gerrymander on race. You can't carve up districts in a way that takes into account race. And so the question
is, but you can take into account partisanship.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And so as long as the legislatures don't do that. So from one perspective, it's like, well, people can say, well, we carved it up and we didn't really pay attention to race. We're only paying attention to party. And that's how you can achieve that. From another perspective, and from African Americans' perspective, it's like, well, yeah, you've only paid attention to party, but look what's happened. We can't elect anyone like us to the legislature, and that is a fact as well. And the immediate effect of this ruling is going to be that you're going to have a huge reduction in the number of African Americans represented in legislatures across the South, not just in Congress, but also for the state legislature.
And for people that don't understand it, I knew somebody, a family of doctors, and dad kept 51% of the practice, and he gave the sons 49%. And the sons realized that they didn't really have anything because dad had 51%. He had the controlling interest. It's kind of the same thing when it comes to this, right? When it comes to representation, where you can have 49%, it can look pretty equal, but come to find out, you're never going to win because you always got that 51% against you.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, where we're headed with this redistricting. I mean, whoever holds the power in the state, you're talking about structural advantages a while ago. I mean, Republicans hold trifectas. They hold both legislative chambers and the governorship in a lot of these states. They're going to get to dictate what the districts look like, and they're going to heavily advantage them. If not, you know, they will take all of the pie, not just 90% of it. And Democrats the same way on the other side. So we could be to a situation where we have this hyper partisan redistricting, and you get representatives who go to the legislatures and they represent their constituents, but their constituents, as they see them, are just people in their political party. So, and I think ultimately what we're headed to is we think we have polarization in legislatures now. We're really going to have it, you know, 10, 15 years from now.
We get bluer and redder.
Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
At the end of the day, Americans are very divided about redistricting, but there's one thing they agree on. There's too much money swirling in the political election system. Here's Phil Mateer on KCBS.
A poll from Politico has found an issue that Democrats and Republicans can agree on, if you can believe it. It's that too much money is being spent on politics. So, Phil, can you tell us a little bit about this poll?
Yes, it's by Politico. And Politico is a nonpartisan sort of inside baseball news organization. It's very good, as a matter of fact. And indeed, the poll does show that people, Republicans and Democrats alike, decry the multi-million dollar industry that it's become and the spending that's come around in every election. But Rebecca, I want to make a quick note or a little caveat. Politico polled voters, not the people that are actually in the elections. Because let me tell you, while candidates decry the use of big money, whether it's in state or the presidency or wherever, both sides use it all the time and have no plans to not stop using it. And when efforts are made to stop use it or expose it, they oppose it. Why? Because they want it.
Yeah. And something that I want to point out is, you know, I think part of the reason why people don't like money being so prevalent in politics is because they feel that it's an effort to buy the election.
Now, the poll showed that 3 out of 4 voters feel that big money either can buy an election or heavily influence it. And I'm going to say, when it comes to initiative, let's say like California, when we had the idea about whether or not to allow sports betting on the internet. Okay, you might remember that. Yeah, it's hard to forget. There was a commercial every 10 seconds on that.
Yes.
The Indian tribes opposed it. The DraftKings and the other big betting operations, they wanted it. They spent up over $200 million on that issue, and it went down in defeat. That's where the real money is. The other money, okay, you have a Tom Steyer. And here's another irony. Tom Steyer is a billionaire who spent more money than I think just about anybody else combined in that race. And he is running as a billionaire, and he has the support of most of the progressive politicians who decry the use of big money.
Yeah, so
go
now
figure.
I have another question regarding that. So could spending all this money actually have an opposite effect, turning people off?
It does have a boomerang effect. And you can ask Meg Whitman and others who have spent lots of money, because exposure is not necessarily a good thing. People can get tired of you, or they feel like they've heard it. And you pounding them constantly, it actually starts to drag. But money is the way that people communicate these days, and it's become a big business in politics, in part because there's a whole group of consultants and advisors who get commissions on that money being spent. If they send it out in mail, they get a slice of that. If they buy it on TV and radio, they get a slice of that. So it's become Now, big money is scary. Big money is something you can rail against, because big is bad, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. But what's really starting to wear on people's nerves is the little money. Every time you turn around, and, you know, I'm sure it's happened to you, how many texts do you get from politicians or organizations seeking money at every turn?
Oh, it's nonstop.
The most ironic one I got over the weekend was from an unnamed person running for Congress that said, "You're going to love this, Rebecca." This had opened like this: "I'd like to give my mother her dream for a Mother's Day present. Send me $10 so I can get elected to president in Congress and make her dream come true."
Wow. Yeah. Doesn't it just warm your heart, Phil?
Yeah, that's the antisocial aspect of social media. Yep. All right.
All right. Thanks very much, Phil.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.